Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 59, the final installment for 2019. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you all for tuning in to Talking Tudors this year and wish you all a safe and joyous Christmas and New Year. Thank you for supporting my podcast, for sharing links to the episodes on social media, and for all your wonderful emails, messages, and comments. Since the start of the year, it's been my absolute pleasure to chat with more than 40 amazing guests, and 2020 is shaping up to be just as exciting. I have lots in the pipeline, including taking Talking Tudors on tour. Watch this space for details. I'd also like to thank my wonderful patrons for their immense generosity. Remember, if you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. December's prize is a copy of House of Grey, Friends and Foes of Kings by Melita Thomas. A huge thank you to Melita for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm excited that joining me on the show is house historian Melanie Backhanson. Melanie is an independent historian, writer, and speaker, specializing in the social history of houses across the United Kingdom. The main focus of Melanie's work involves original research for homeowners and corporate clients to provide research reports and bespoke house history books. Melanie is a research consultant for A House Through Time, BBC Two, and was also series historical consultant for Phil Spencer's History of Britain in 100 Homes. Melanie's first book, House Histories, The Secrets Behind Your Front Door, was released in a second updated edition in November 2019. She's also the author of Historic Streets and Squares, The Secrets on Your Doorstep, and is currently working on a new book due out in 2020. My conversation with Melanie straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors. Melanie, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you today. I thought we could begin by you just telling us a little bit about your background and a bit about yourself.
Well, yes. My name is Melanie Backhanson. I'm a house historian, which often confuses people, largely because it's a very rare kind of field. A lot of people assume that means architectural historian or they don't know quite what. But in essence, I look at the social history of houses. So it's all about uncovering the details of a house in terms of when it was built, perhaps who was responsible for building it, but then all the stories of people connected to the house. So who were the owners? Who were the first people to walk through the door? What were their stories? And so building up a picture, a social history picture of the history of a house. And it's largely through delving through lots of different historic records, lots of different documents, piecing together all those different details to find the story of a house and all the people that lived there.
Well, that sounds wonderful, right up my alley, actually. And so could you tell us a little bit, so a kind of a day in the life of a house historian, what's that like?
Well, it's always different, which is quite a treat. So obviously, depending on the house, it will depend on where I am and what I'm doing. So mainly the archives for houses are held within the county or the borough or the area for where that house is situated. So if it's in Lincolnshire, I have to go up to Lincoln. If it's in Cornwall, I have to go down to Cornwall. If it's in London, then it's a borough in London. So depending on the house, depends on where I will be. And also there are increasingly some records online, so that's helpful. So quite often I'm perhaps just staring at my laptop, but it's always different. And if I'm in an archive, then again, the archives are always different. So each individual house will have its own different records. And you can actually research, you know, houses, two houses in the same street, and you'll end up looking at different records and your journey will be different through the story of the house. So it's quite, I mean, that's the fun of it, really, because it is like being a bit of a detective, and you're following the trail of the clues that lead you to the story of the house. So, and also it's the variety of knowing, you know, whatever house you look into, whether it's a Tudor house or whether it's a Georgian house or even if it's a sort of 20th century house, actually there's always something different. You'll always find different stories, and that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely wonderful. So it sounds like it involves a lot of travel.
It can do, yes. So yeah, that is one of the challenges. but it's what goes with it, and I don't mind that. Obviously it's a treat to be able to travel to different parts of the UK, and you know, you do spend most of your time in archives or then in the hotel at the end of the day,
right.
but it is lovely. It's quite a nice mix. So you know, I go through times when I do lots of London houses, and that's really fortunate. I live in London, so that's easy. Jump on the tube, jump on the bus, and you're there. But then it's quite nice to be able to head up to Yorkshire or to down to Wiltshire or wherever it is, and actually have a bit of a trip away. So it's cool.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. And do you visit every house that you actually research?
In most cases, yes. Obviously, the architectural features will be of value, and you need to be aware of, you know, you need to look at that and see what clues that might tell you. But in some cases, I don't, largely because, well, there are two reasons why. I think when I first started, I actually worked for an estate agent, and that's how I came to specialize in houses. So I went off, and quite often there may only be a few days to sort of piece together, hopefully more than a few days, but there might be a short period of time where I have to just piece together an overview of the history of a house. And in a lot of cases, all I got was a photograph and the address.
Right.
And I would then only have time to go to the archives and do as much research as possible. But then in other cases, it's because the owners actually are trying to keep it a secret because it's a gift. So, for example, I did a house in Yorkshire earlier this year, and it was a gift from a husband to wife, and there was no way of my visiting without spoiling the surprise.
Right,
So he just took as many photographs as possible to sort of hopefully give me enough information, and then I just spent the rest of the time in the archives and piecing it all together. So yeah, there's a mixture, but in a lot of cases it is just, yeah, you visit the house and at least get a bit of an overview. Yeah.
And what a lovely gift. That's a really thoughtful gift that husband gave to his wife.
Yeah, actually a lot of my private commissions, it's often a gift.
Right.
So it's, yeah, in many cases it's, you know, husbands and wives. I had a house where it was actually siblings, three children who are adults now, who wanted to give a house history book to their parents because the parents were selling the family home and downsizing, and this, you know, they lived in the house for 40 years, and it was quite a nice special gift.
Oh, what a lovely gift. Yeah. Now, I'd love to talk about some of the Tudor houses that you've researched. Yes. So can you tell us a little bit about some of those?
Yes, I should say, I mean, it's not rare exactly, but they don't often come up because a lot of sort of residential Tudor houses are, well, they've either changed beyond all recognition or they're no longer here. But then the larger Tudor houses, quite often the histories are already known. You know, they were owned by a prominent local family or aristocratic family, and the history is quite often already recorded. But there are still an awful lot of Tudor houses that no one really knows the stories. Probably the oldest house I've ever researched was actually an old chantry house, and it was actually built in the 1490s as a chantry. So it was essentially built by a benefactor it was actually a couple, and they wanted, well, in the old sort of religious terms of the time, they wanted a priest to have a place to pray for their souls, effectively. Yes. And it was a chantry, and it was a chantry priest who would live there. So the house was built in 1490s. It was quite basic. And then obviously there was the dissolution of the monasteries, and then the dissolution of the chantries that came later, in 1547. So it had about 50 years of being a functioning chantry house. But then after that, it was acquired by a local family, and a prominent local family became part of the manor. And probably the most unique and special thing about this house is that it still retains an awful lot of those original late 15th, early 16th century details. So it has an old guard rope that's still there. It has the staircase that was built at the time. It has a lot of timber paneling. It's actually grade one listed, which is for a residential home is rather rare, because normally most homes are grade two or grade two star, but grade one is the equivalent of Westminster Abbey or yes, St Paul's Cathedral. So yeah, it had just such a spectacular interior, where it was the timber paneling. You could still see the form of the old hall, and then what is now the kitchen was where the, you know, the service areas was, and you had the buttery and things like that. So it just had extraordinary original features. What was quite funny is that they did add a bathroom in the 1930s, as most people did. But what's curious is, even though it's not Tudor, the 1930s bathroom also hasn't been changed or you know, renovated since then. So it had this extraordinary original 1930s bathroom alongside Tudor timber paneling and you know, all the details, the enormous chimney and fireplace. So it was quite a house.
It sounds amazing. I'd love to live in a house like that.
Yeah, I know. Actually, for Tudor fans, you would just die. Because it literally looked like a Tudor hall as it would have been at the time. So it was quite impressive. But there are other houses. There's probably one of the best ones I've done recently was actually an old farmhouse. As a lot, the other thing about Tudor houses, if they're still around today, they would be or would have been the home of a wealthy farmer or a fairly wealthy merchant or someone of that status, because if anyone sort of further down the social scale, their houses are long gone. You know, a lot of the old hovels or old labourers' cottages, that sort of small dwelling has long gone. However, this is a house I researched in Gloucestershire, and it started out as a small farmhouse. But what was quite amazing is that it was extended in the 18th century, so now it's a large family home in the middle of the Cotswolds, and it's beautiful. But the old part of the house is still the kitchen, and it's still got elements of the timber ceiling, and it's got elements of fireplaces, and it's like most houses, it has been done up and changed and renovated, so you see glimpses of the Tudor original, but it's a lot of it's covered over. However, when I was delving through the records, it was when looking at the history of houses, you sort of go backwards in time. So I got all the way back to sort of the 18th century, and it got a little stuck. The documents ran out, which can happen, especially in a rural location where the deeds have long gone and that sort of thing. But I ended up sort of persevering, and the client allowed me to spend more time researching. And I found a sort of elusive deed hidden in the archives. And it was actually a 17th century deed, but it traced the ownership of the property back to the 16th century. And so it actually revealed, it was a marriage agreement, so it was providing the details of ownership of property that was going to pass when two people married. And it gave the story, and it revealed that in 1588, Queen Elizabeth I had acquired the property. And yeah, I know. It was like, amazing. Yay, the queen. But she didn't hang on to it for very long. So it was granted to her by the Bishop of Worcester. So he was obviously trying to carry favour and get into her good books. But she didn't hang on to it for very long. So she then passed it to her personal physician at the time, who was a Dr. Lopez. And he has an enormously fascinating history, but also quite complicated. But it got a little bit embroiled in the sort of court politics and court drama. And he was accused of trying to poison the queen. Very complicated story, but in essence, he got accused of trying to poison the queen. He claimed his innocence throughout the process, but he was put on the rack. He was tortured. He then said he was trying to poison the queen and confessed. He then, when he got off the rack, he then, you know, took away his confession, as you would. You'd say anything to get off the rack. But as it was, he was found guilty and he was executed in 1594. The drama was such headline news at the time and was such a scandal that it's believed to be the inspiration for a number of plays, one by Marlowe, but also by Shakespeare. It's believed Lopez was the inspiration for Shylock in The Merchant of Venice.
I was just going to say, it sounds like it would make a good novel, but obviously Shakespeare beat me to
it. That's the thing, when you read the story, and it's as I say, it's quite complicated, but you just read it's typical sort of Tudor court drama. But it was a fascinating story. And what was probably, well, it was most shocking to me is that now this is large gentleman's home and it's a family residence in the middle of the Cotswolds. But it led to this dramatic story of execution and Elizabeth I and Shakespeare. And of course, the client loved it. So
I can imagine.
So there's all sorts. Obviously, you can find all sorts of stories.
That's so fantastic. What a great job you have, Melanie, by the way. That's just not jealous at all. Not jealous at all. So you've mentioned some of those features that we'd find in 16th century houses. Can you go into that a little bit more and tell us maybe what you've come across? So we hear that, you know, the big fireplaces and the lovely timber paneling. Is there anything else that you kind of go, oh yeah, Tudor house when you see that?
I mean, as I said, it's quite tricky because obviously a lot of Tudor, the original details have been covered over through different centuries. So in a number of cases, especially if it's in the walls, for example, if you've got a timber framed structure, sometimes that's covered over and you can't actually tell. But that would be one of the first clues. Obviously, timber framing was one of the most popular forms of construction for a house at the time. But also house building at that point, it was very vernacular. So it was very localized. It was very regional. So timber framing was very popular and that was the sort of most common form of structure. But of course, then you get a stone and all sorts of different types of stone structures. Less likely brick. I mean, if you had brick at that point, you were super wealthy and you're probably a royal, like the kind of the caliber of level of cost of the building. So for sort of ordinary houses, you're looking at timber framing. Then you get things like mullion windows, which are basically a squared windows, but or sort of rectangular size. But you get these mullions, which are the sort of vertical struts between the windows. And then you had casement windows within those later. Casement windows are the ones that open sideways, as opposed to a sash window, which we're all familiar with. Windows were quite tricky as well, because original Tudor windows may not have had glass at all. And actually, they may have only had sort of a cloth covering or a shutter. Glass was very expensive at that time. So it was only later that you may get a Tudor house which has mullions, but then the glass is fitted within those. So it's that also, you know, you have to sort of look at those different changes. The other, obviously, one of the most common things that people think of when they think of a Tudor house are the jetties. So if you're in a town, so one of the most famous is obviously the Shambles in York. Urban environment, so this would have happened across the country. So whether you're in London or whether you're in Exeter or wherever you were, the towns and well, at that point, they were just small towns in most cases. And you would have had narrow plots and they were usually marked out because they were maximizing space within a town and it costs more to sort of take more of the high street, if you like. So they built houses lengthways back from the main frontage of the street. So you get these long, narrow plots. And in order to sort of build up, they would create these jetties because you couldn't build outwards. So you would Yeah, in order to sort of expand, and obviously when there was a bit of wealth that came in during the 16th century, people expanded upwards. And so the only way to do that was to sort of create this larger floor space above for the walls to rest on. And then you started getting these jetties. So the floor would jut out as each level was built. So you get the very familiar looking jetties that look out over the street. So that's probably the most common sort of things that you would see. Obviously, yeah, large fireplaces. Again, it was at the Tudor times that a lot of people moved, whether you're in a rural or an urban location, you had your fire actually in the middle of the hall, sort of in an old medieval way. And it was through the Tudor period, over a period of time, that people started fitting fireplaces and chimneys. And that was actually a really important feature, and it changed the way houses could be built, because you then could have a floor that went across the length of the house, as opposed to leaving the hall free to have the smoke escape out the thatch roof. So you then had, yeah, chimneys were built on the sides of houses, and you could therefore obviously have more warmth, but then you could build floors. So yeah, there was actually a lot of change, and obviously it's just over a period of time, so you're talking over 100-150 years that houses could evolve in this way. So yeah, there's lots of features, but with Tudor houses you do become a bit of a detective, and you're looking at timber staircases and how old they were and whether they were Tudor or whether they were 17th century or whatever. But hopefully that gives a few clues.
Yeah, definitely. And it's so fun, isn't it? It is exactly detective work, like you say. It's just also interesting, such an interesting period of time. Now, Melanie, you've told us about some memorable stories. I love the one of Dr. Lopez. Are there any other, do you have any other sort of favourite, even if they're not about the Tudors, that's fine, any other memorable stories from your research that you've done?
Yeah, and this is always a tricky question, actually, because I always get fascinated by whatever house I'm working on. Yeah. So, and it is really tricky, but there's always something you can find. Yeah, the Dr. Lopez Shakespeare thing is definitely one of the best. But there's lots of things you can find, even probably some of the more recent. I've delved into a house which was built in the 17th century, and it was a large farmhouse in a sort of small rural village, and it was home to prominent local yeoman farmers, sort of free farmers, rather than being tied to the manor. And so it had a sort of, I guess you could say, fairly simple early history. You know, it was farmers and their families, and that was interesting. The local area sort of had some drama with the Civil War and things like that. But it was later in the 20th century. Oh, no, I should say in the 19th century, by this point, it was still just a farmer's house, home to a large farming family. So it was farmers, and I think it was eight children. And that they continued on. But what was really fascinating, they lived in the house for, I think, 30 or 40 years. But in the first floor windows of the house today, even now, there are names scratched into the glass. And the current owners have always been obviously really curious as to where these scratchings came from and who was responsible. And it turns out it was this farming family in the mid 19th century, and there was two girls who out of this, obviously several children, and actually at the time of the census they had a governess. So I always imagine the governess getting furious because they've been scratching their names into the glass. But I actually found the family in the details, and it matched obviously with the names of the girls on the windows. So it was extraordinary that they're still there, you know, sort of almost 150 years later. So it really brought them to life, actually, which was quite special. But then in the 20th century, it became more of a gentleman's home. It was renovated and became more of a country house. And it was home to, well, an aristocratic family. They were quite wealthy. And as it turns out, the eldest son, he went off to fight he fought in the First World War, but also fought in the Second World War, and ended up fighting with the Special Operations Executive, which was a special unit created by Winston Churchill to help the resistance fighters in occupied parts of the world. So that's often referred to as France, but they sort of helped resistance fighters all over the country, wherever there was a war. And in this case, the son of the family, he went off to fight in the Middle East, actually. So it was slightly different. It wasn't in the middle of France or Germany. But he was actually, they were told he was reported missing in 1941, but as it happened, he was actually killed in 1941, but they only found out in 1943, so which I always find quite harsh, because it's for 2 years they had no news, but actually he had actually died in an action in 1941. But then it turns out his widow, who at that point she actually gave birth to their second child while he was fighting, she stayed at the house with her mother-in-law, and so there's a bit of a story there with the sort of matriarch of the family. But the widow, she ended up becoming a lady-in-waiting to Princess Elizabeth, who became Queen Elizabeth II. So another Queen Elizabeth. But it was quite a twist to find that obviously they were from an aristocratic family, but so she became lady-in-waiting to Princess Elizabeth. And then when she was crowned in 1953, she became the lady-in-waiting to Queen Elizabeth II. So this whole thing unraveled with, you know, sort of a gentleman's residence in the 1930s. And then all of a sudden you've got another queen and you've got fighting in the special operations executive. So there's that sort of thing. So there's all sorts of things. I mean, there's so many different stories of houses where you might find, yeah, a war hero, or you might find a bit of drama. You know, I found a few cases where there was divorces and all sorts of drama, houses where people were basically criminals and they were arrested and found, you know, taken to prison, and all sorts of drama that can unfold. And each era is the same. And it's, you know, Tudor houses are a bit more tricky to investigate because there's fewer records, but you'll always find something. There's always a good story.
How fascinating. I imagine the clients are just thrilled when you hand over that history. Yes. It's so exciting. Love it. Now, not only do you research houses, but you obviously have to research, you know, the area that the houses are in, and you've done a little bit of research into streets as well throughout the UK. Have you ever had to or found or researched any streets with any Tudor links?
They obviously, in many cases, the familiar high streets across the country would have been streets at the time of the Tudors, but probably, as I mentioned earlier, I have done a little research into the Shambles in York, and is the case for many. They started out as a market street. It was actually started out as the Butcher's Street. It's actually much, much older given the history of York, but it became sort of more prominent in the Tudor period as this Butcher's Street, and actually it was called Flesh Ambles, so the flesh for meat, and that then got shortened to Shambles. But it's sort of heyday, and why it became this. And it's fortunate that it survived, because obviously if you think most towns had streets like this, but the Shambles in New York has survived with a lot of renovation, I might add. But it was just a fascinating story of an ordinary street. And I think this is the thing. Sometimes we get carried away with the sort of grand palaces or the stately homes, but actually these sort of ordinary streets, which were just home to merchants and traders and ordinary people. And fortunately, we still have that street today. But there's many others. But one of another that I researched was Elm Hill in Norwich. It's known as being a historic street, and Norwich is one of the sort of most prominent older cities in the country. But actually, it suffered heavily with a fire in 1507. So actually, it was a medieval street and had, you know, a lot of heritage and a lot of older houses before this, but a fire swept through in 1507 and almost destroyed the entire street, pretty much. So like Shambles in York, it was a trading street. It was right by the river, so a lot of people were, you know, undertaking business and trading, and so when the fire swept through, they still had to make money and trade, so they quickly rebuilt. And that's one of the features in the fact that they just quickly built on the same with the Great Fire of London in a lot of ways, where they had to get back to business, and so they had to rebuild quickly. So a lot of the houses were built almost immediately after the fire, but they therefore date very clearly to the early 1500s, the early 16th century. And so, but what was unique is actually the ground floor, whereas the medieval houses prior to that would have all been timber framed, but when they rebuilt, they actually built a lot of the ground floor area in stone, and then the upper floors in timber. So that became a feature as well, because obviously they wanted to improve the houses, but also do something to prevent future fires as well, which is always a concern at that time. But again, it was protected, and actually in a lot of cases they became very run down streets, so in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, and fortunately they survived to be protected. And so now it's obviously Elm Hill in Norwich is a popular tourist destination, but it still holds a glimpse of what it was like, you know, when Tudors were walking down the streets. So, yeah, always interesting.
It is, yeah, and I find the Shambles so atmospheric. If you kind of get out there before the throngs of tourists, it's quite amazing, isn't it? It's a bit like time travel. You're just walking in their footsteps, literally. So it's amazing. I love York. Now, you mentioned you spend a lot of time in the archives doing your research. So can you tell us what some of the sources are that you use to research the history of houses?
Yeah, there are quite a lot. and it's a common thing to sort of refer to it as like doing a puzzle, but without the box to show you what the final picture will be. But in essence, and as I said earlier, I work backwards in time. So in a lot of cases, the records, early records, don't clearly identify houses. So in order to know exactly which house and make sure you're researching the right house, you actually have to start sort of in more recent times or from a period where you're certain of the facts. So you're certain of the name of the house or the name of the occupant, or the street address, and you work backwards in time, so largely from the 20th century. And that involves electoral registers, trade directories, which are like a phone book effectively, or no one uses phone books now either, but it was a list of names, and originally started out as a list of traders, but became more commonly it was a street address. So yeah, you would be able to identify who the head of the house living at that address. But then there's also census records, which people might know from genealogy programs. Then there's tax records, which don't sound very exciting, but they really useful for house histories, actually, because there's a number of different types as well. So you've got things like land tax, and you've got local taxes, which we might know as council tax now, but in previous times, they were divided up into different taxes, often known as a rate. And the most common of those is a poor rate. So it was a tax on occupants of houses to provide poor relief in the community. But those records that survive give the name of the ratepayer at that address. So you're able to identify the names of people through different years. But then there's obviously maps are another key source, and that can, you know, there's different types of maps that can show you lots of different clues, some of which will identify the house clearly, but then some others may not show the house clearly in a pictorial sense, but they are accompanied by a record that gives you the name of the owner and the occupant. So there's lots of different maps that become useful. And as you go back, then you get into things like deeds, which are probably the most common source for Tudor houses, along with sort of parish registers, which are births, marriages and deaths. But deeds, they're no longer legally required to be kept in their entirety beyond 15 years. So in the 20th century, a lot of deeds basically got thrown out or lost or discarded because they were no longer needed, and which is always a bit tragic for someone like me. Mm-hmm. But you can still find them, obviously. So if, you know, solicitors or mortgage providers might still hold the deeds to a house, but a lot of them are retained in historic collections, so which are held in the archives. So that could be an old family collection or an old solicitor's collection, and they just gave everything to the archives. So you can find these sort of elusive deeds. As I was referring to the one with the Shakespeare link, I found a 17th century deed that gave all the details but further back. So there's a whole pile, there's all sorts of things. Effectively, each county will also be different, so that's the other that's the other fun. So actually, wherever your house is, you'll end up on a different journey. So it just depends. So what records they've retained, what records are relevant to the individuals that are connected to a particular house. The detective thing comes out again, and you piece it together. Lots of different details, and you're able to gain the name of someone here, and then that leads you to something else, and it's lots of different pieces.
Okay, and I imagine that some of our listeners are probably thinking, oh, I'd like to, you know, trace the history of my house. So you've given us lots of tips there, lots of things. Is there anything else that you would say to anyone who's perhaps thinking about tracing the history of their house?
Yeah, as I said, probably the key one is to work backwards. Okay. That's a key clue. The other thing is street names and house numbers. They change quite a lot. Even in the 20th century and even further back in the 19th, they effectively changed when developments took place or so a new owner came along and they decided to change the name. So that can be a bit of a challenge if you're tracing through different records and it's not clearly identified. So which is one of the main reasons to work backwards, because then you start actually tracing the names of people rather than the name of the house or the street address, because actually street addresses are rarely specified so clearly on older records. So for example, I'm doing one at the moment in Surrey, and it has one name now, which was fitted in the 20th century, but back into the 19th century it had a different name, and then in the early 19th century it doesn't appear to have any name at all. So quite often it's just called, so in a lot of old records it's just called mesurage, or which is another word for home or house. So it could just be literally the house on the street. And so if you're tracing that, you need to know the names of people in order to be clear as to which house and which street. So that can be a bit of a challenge. But having said that, it's quite often only in the older records. So if you're tracing the history of your own home, you can get an awful way back, you know, following the trail of the address and following the trail of the names of people. And yeah, you will piece it together and you'll start seeing the clues. And if there's any gaps, you can sort of fill those gaps by looking at other records. So yeah, they're probably my two biggest clues or tips is to watch out for.
That's really helpful. And of course, yeah, because we're in sort of that mindset, aren't we, of addresses, very firm addresses for our houses.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always like that. So that is such a great point. Thank you for that. Now, you've written two books that are full of the stories you've uncovered during your research of houses and streets in the UK. Can you tell us a little bit about the books and where people can get a hold of them?
Yes. Well, my first book, House Histories, that has just come out as a new edition in the last couple of weeks. So that should be available, obviously, on all online retailers and bookshops. So you should be able to get a hold of that without any trouble. And that effectively is a collection of different house stories. So there's almost 100 different stories of houses, and big houses, small houses, some known, some not known. And it's all the stories of different houses across different parts of the country. And again, it's trying to sort of reveal that even a sort of ordinary looking house, it may just look like a sort of Victorian terrace, but actually can hold extraordinary history. So, and there's a couple of the Tudor stories in there, so you can find those. But it's the unraveling of different stories of houses. Then my second book, Historic Streets and Squares, is more of a collection of more famous, well-known streets and squares across the country, but how they became that. So how, you know, it's the Shambles is in there, Elm Hill is in there, but places like Soho Square in London or Charlotte Square in Edinburgh or all over the country, there's different sort of well-known locations that people are familiar with, but how did they become that? So that, you know, Petticoat Lane or lots of different places in the country. So it's a bit of a hidden one, because actually quite often we look at what's there now, but looking back into how they became what they are and their histories. So all sorts of stories of riots and, you know, traders and how they became famous and the famous people that lived on them and all that sort of thing.
Okay, well, there are two fantastic things to add to our Christmas list, I think, everybody listening, because they sound great. And I can imagine that Petticoat Lane has a very interesting story behind it.
Yeah,
I love that. I love the street names and, you know, when they're connected to what went on there in the past and that sort of stuff. That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for that. Now, we're at that time of the episode where we play our little game of 10 to go. So these are 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for that?
Right. I think so.
Yeah, I think you'll be fine. So number one, would you like to share with us a favorite childhood memory?
Oh, goodness. That's really tough. The first thing that comes to mind is actually just holidays with my family. But I'm not sure if anyone guessed, but I grew up in Australia. So
yes, I can hear a slight accent, by the way. Yes. Sydney cider accent underneath.
I know. Some people pick it, some people don't. So I'm just thinking of holidays with my family up the coast in a place called Shoal Bay, which is Port Stephens Way. And that's probably the best thing that comes to mind. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. I like that. Do you have a bucket list, and what are two things that might be on that bucket list?
I don't really have a bucket list, I have to say. But if there's things that, I mean, there's always things in the back of my mind that I think, oh, I must do that. Even in London, and I think, There's galleries I've not been to, or historic houses I've not been to, and I always think, oh, I really must do that, and still it's on that list. But I'm just trying to think if there's anything really. I don't know. I mean, there's nothing really dramatic, but I don't know. I have actually already been skydiving, so
Oh,
that
have
sort of
you?
thing.
So you've ticked a. Oh, goodness, you're brave.
Yeah. So in total, that was the 21st birthday present. Which I
Wow.
loved and would do again in a minute. It is things like historic houses and things around the corner that I
Yes.
still haven't been to. So I'm just thinking there's like Hogarth House in London, which is West London, or even just Somerset House in the middle of London, and I've never been to the gallery there. So things like that,
Yeah,
which,
that's brilliant. An unofficial bucket list you have. You haven't
yeah,
formalized it,
absolutely.
but
Yeah,
it's a, all
absolutely.
right. And what's a new skill that you would like to learn?
I'm not really good on technology, so I'd probably
Right.
be good. Like, actually, recently a lot of people have said, oh, you should try and do little film clips of yourself around houses and
Oh,
streets.
yeah, that'd be
And
good.
yeah, so I'm attempting to sort of try and do that, but
Yeah.
the idea, I have really short arms and I'm a bit rubbish at selfies, so the thought of trying to film myself seems really awkward. So that is definitely a skill that I need to perhaps perfect and learn. That's probably the first thing that comes to
Okay.
mind.
Yeah, you need one of those like selfie things that
I
people
know,
carry,
I
those
have
sticks
actually
or
invested in a selfie stick, so I need
Oh,
to
there you
learn
go.
how to use that.
Yeah, that's all right. Do you have a favorite season?
I'd probably say autumn,
Yeah.
especially in the UK. For a start, I like colder weather, so I like it when it gets nippy and it's chilly outside. And so autumn, when the leaves change and it just looks spectacular, I love that time of year.
And what's something you do to unwind?
Probably, I guess, time with friends. It's probably the cliche, but I don't know, going for dinner or drinks with friends and just a good conversation. That's probably the I do. I used to say reading, obviously, but I read so much for work, so quite
Yes,
often
yeah.
I do read, but it's
Yeah, you
I
probably need a
we
little
say
break
spoopy
sometimes.
unwind. It's got to be just relaxing with friends. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. And what's your ideal Sunday morning?
Sleep in first.
Sleeping.
Yeah, definitely sleep in, relax, put on a nice pot of coffee. Oh no, chill out in front of the television. But also maybe I live in a sort of busy part of London, so quite often I think, oh, I'd love to go for a walk in the country, but I'm a bit far from that. So yeah, it's probably, a good sleep and then putting on coffee, having a nice breakfast. Nice brunch with friends is always a treat as well, so.
And what's an inspirational place that you like to visit that's maybe close to home or maybe not?
That's a good
Probably got
question.
lots in London, I can.
Yeah, I think that's it.
You've got too
I
many,
think
that's the problem, I
I
think.
know that is that's definitely the case. And like going back to sort of the bucket list question, I think I need to do a bit more going to galleries and
Yep.
museums and just sort of taking in history, actually. So yeah, recently I have often visited Bath because I know some people there, and it's a favourite part of the world for me. And every time I go, I tell myself I have to do one thing I haven't done before. So whether that's the last time I climbed the bell tower at Bath Abbey and then went to a gallery, and so things like that. So I need to
Yeah.
perhaps do more of that in London, which is, it's always a bit tricky when you live in a place and you get so used to it, but you need to sort of make an effort to step
Yeah,
out.
that's so true. I know that happens to everyone. I think wherever you live, you kind of, yeah, you just take it, yeah, for granted a little bit, don't you? Because you see it all the time.
Definitely.
All right, so name a person from the past, any period of history that you'd love to meet.
Goodness, I don't know. I guess it seems a bit cliche, but I'd quite like the idea of meeting Jane Austen.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good.
And also because she seems so, like, as a person, she seems so sort of understated. She was just this single woman who wrote wonderful stories. But to actually go and visit the Austens and hang out and have tea, and I think it would be quite nice just to chat. She'd probably be just like a really good girlfriend that you just chat with and hang out with. So yeah, that's probably my answer is Jane
Jane
Austen.
Austen, okay, that's great. And lucky last, since we're of course in the festive season, do you have a favourite Christmas tradition?
Well, with my family, I'd probably say, again, my Christmases are in Australia, so they're slightly different. But
Oh, yeah.
we had quite a traditional Christmas. So we still obviously had the Christmas tree and had the full roast for lunch and all that sort of thing. But probably one of my most fun sort of traditions we have as a family is actually taking it in turns to unwrap our presents, and everyone, rather than it sort of being a free-for-all,
yes.
and everyone like unwrapping presents at the same time, but actually we take time and everyone gets their turn of unwrapping a present, so everyone sees what they get, and I quite like that. It's part of the family sort of tradition and the family time, so I'd probably say that, but that's not very historic.
No, it doesn't have to be historic. No, I like that.
Tradition. Yeah.
Exactly. And it kind of makes it, you know, it goes for longer then when instead of everyone just going.
Yeah, make the most of it. So we have, you know, copious amounts of coffee, or we might have a bit of champagne or whatever. Mm-hmm. And actually just, it's spending time and I quite like that.
Yeah, I love that. So is Christmas in London this year, or are you coming to Oz for Christmas?
I am actually coming to Oz. I'm flying Christmas Eve. I have the enjoyment of spending Christmas Day in the air. And then I land on Boxing Day, and then so it doesn't actually change too much. We just celebrate on Boxing Day instead. It's quite a treat. So
oh, how lovely! That's really lovely. Excellent.
Very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, that sounds great. We are a little smoky at the moment. I hope you're prepared for that. But
I think it's not everywhere.
Yes. So you should. I think you were in the north, weren't you? Northern suburbs, I think. So.
Yes, although my family have now moved to Shoal Bay, which is off the coast. So they are on the coast, so I think they're okay. But
it'll just be the smoky. But that's all right, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
All will be well. Yeah,
hopefully it will go down in the next few weeks because we need to. The fires look so horrendous. So
We're all praying for rain. So anyone listening, please do a rain dance for us. That would be really helpful.
Absolutely.
Now, Melanie, the last thing I ask of my guests is for what I call a tutor takeaway. So something that our listeners can go off and explore after the episode. It might be a favorite film of yours to watch, or a song to listen to, or a website to check out. Do you have a tutor takeaway?
Well, yes. This is actually quite a tricky question, but the first thing that came to mind was actually a book by Ruth Goodman, How to Be a Tudor. So I probably, your listeners probably know all about it, but the key with it is that it's ordinary people, and I'm a big believer, and I think a lot of my work is involved in the stories of ordinary people, so those that have sort of been lost in time, and you're rediscovering them through the research. So How to Be a Tudor by Ruth Goodman is a guide through everyday life for ordinary Tudors. And I really like that. I love the fact that it's telling the story about what sort of ordinary Tudors would have done, how they worked, how they lived, how they washed or didn't wash, or, you know, all those kinds of stories. And that's partly linked with the houses as well. So how they lived in their houses and how they went about their daily lives. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, that's a great recommendation. I love that too. And I love those, you know, learning about the nitty gritty of everyday life, I think is fantastic. Mm. So great takeaway. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk Tudors with us today.
That's no problem. Loved it.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.